certain people in the United States economy were getting extraordinarily wealthy, but the majority of Americans, like for decades, were suffering. They just weren't doing very well. They were getting forced into factory work. The farmers who managed to stick it out weren't doing very well, like for decades. And that finally began to let up under McKinley.
Hello, and welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast. I am in charge of podcasting, Rory McElhone, and in charge of politics is Robert Morris.
How you doing today, Rory?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. How are you?
No real complaints. It's March, and apparently that's beautiful spring weather time in New York City now, so been out having a lovely time jogging in t-shirts and whatnot. So,
that's what I like to
hear. Let's hear for global warming.
Yeah. Speaking of that, Ireland doesn't know what to do. Some parts were snowing while others are quite sunny, so it's a bit all over the place.
Just confusion.
Do you want to talk about a president a lot of people are confused by?
I think it's a president that most people are forgetting. And I realized that I kind of have screwed up in my own analysis, my own thinking about U.S. history. I want to talk today about William McKinley.
Number 25.
Yep. And the fact that he's kind of been robbed by Teddy Roosevelt, by Theodore Roosevelt, who's a much more famous president in U.S. history circles, in just sort of popular consciousness, I believe. You've heard of Teddy Roosevelt, right?
I've heard of Teddy Roosevelt, and before you told me about this, I hadn't heard much of McKinley, other than he's just a name that you sort of hear about in American politics, but you could have told me he was a seventh president, and I would have believed you.
Yeah, and even for me, like, I'm pretty good at presidents and can tell you about most of them and most of them in order, but there's the period before the Civil War with a bunch of like not very successful non-entities, and then there's sort of the period after the Civil War with a bunch of not very successful non-entities. Could never really quite sort it out. Today I kind of want to do a bit of a revision to some episodes we did earlier, or a sort of enlargement of sort of early American empire. We talked a lot about Smedley Butler and Woodrow Wilson and sort of the first decades of the 20th century. But I think the sort of origin story for that is that transition between a United States that was all about conquest of the continental United States, conquest of North America, into what we've eventually become, which is a world-spanning empire.
So was that when America would have acted like a sort of knockoff European imperial power?
Exactly. So this is how did
I'm
we...
thinking things like behavior in like the Boxer Rebellion. It's just like, yeah, we're one of the gang.
That's exactly it. And that's the sort of the theft of reputation that I want to talk about here, is that formation of the sort of me too wannabe European empire is usually credited to Teddy Roosevelt, the guy who was president between 1901 and 1908 or 1909 or thereabouts. But actually, it was really William McKinley who, looking at the historical record, looking at the political record, looking at the changes that he brought to the United States through his political success, actually strikes me as a much, much more significant figure than Teddy Roosevelt. I've complained about Teddy Roosevelt. He's the sort of famous kind of buck-tooth guy with the glasses, and he's...
quite the eccentric compared to McKinley.
Well, yeah, he's famous as sort of being swashbuckling, and he loved the outdoors, and he famously gave up a cabinet post to go fight in the Spanish-American War and lead his Rough Riders, his sort of basically a bunch of, I assume, a bunch of fellow plutocrats cosplaying as cowboys, riding horses up a hill in Cuba to beat the Spanish or something like that. You know, he's just I think largely because he had a cousin who ended up being probably the formative 20th century president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in the 1930s and 1940s. He ended up on Mount Rushmore. He's just a very, I think the teddy bear, the stuffed
that's
animal.
Something I heard that, yeah, he wouldn't kill a bear cub, and it was like a sort of nickname that he wasn't this cruel.
Yeah, so the teddy bear comes from Theodore Roosevelt. So essentially, Theodore Roosevelt who was the vice president of William McKinley when William McKinley happened to be assassinated in 1901.
In his second term.
In his second term. Hands the Hugh. He won a very close victory in 1896, which was tremendously important in U.S. history. It's sort of a transition between party systems.
And did he win that by campaigning on his front porch? Is that right?
That, I believe, there's something to that. There's something
I just
you could
think
do.
It's funny considering how much money is spent in elections currently. Like, they never seem to end. As soon as one election ends, it's like, oh, got to get ready for the next one. And now we have a man that just sits on his front porch and says, yeah, I'd like to be in charge.
Well, that's interesting. That was a very traditional thing to do for a presidential candidate. And that was a conscious public relations choice.
Okay.
For William McKinley than it was, more for William McKinley than it was for many others. It's interesting because, yes, he very consciously created this vision of being an old school campaigner and people can come here and talk to me. When in fact, the beginners of the modern campaign industry was this guy named Mark Hanna, who worked for McKinley and is largely credited for his winning this very close election in 1896 on behalf of I think William Evelyn Williams, this book that I just read, complicates this story a little bit, but Mark Hanna and the Eastern plutocrats won it for McKinley, supposedly, through all kinds of novel, brand new marketing strategies for president. Well, of course, William McKinley himself, oh no, I'm just campaigning from the front porch or what have you, where actually there were a bunch of people acting on his part. So what's fascinating is realizing that, well, it's this period of tremendous ferment, the Gilded Age, the sort of last decades of the 20th century, where some people in the United States were becoming extraordinarily wealthy. Like, the number of institutions that are incredibly valuable to the United States that were formed as sort of the afterthoughts of this wealthy class, from, Andrew Carnegie's public libraries to most of the private universities that are so important in the United States. A lot of this, certainly the fabric of New York City, the city that I live in, and all the other East Coast cities. So at the same time here, as this incredible wealth being put together, you had large volumes of people who were feeling left out entirely. This is, of course, the industrial proletariat. Jacob Riis's famous photographs of how the other half lives, of people living in an incredible squalor in urban environments, but also vitally, and this is something that's really focused on in the work of William Appleman Williams, who is a tremendously important historian who we're going to be talking about a lot today, was also the farmers. In the latter 19th century, you still had the majority, or at least a plurality of the people in the United States worked in agriculture. By the first decades of the 20th century, that had faded and it diminished very quickly. But in throughout the Gilded Age, the farmers were independent farmers were a tremendously important political group in the United States. And we've actually heard a lot recently in the context of Trump about the populist movement that they put together. I mean, populist is sort of a catch-all derogatory term now for Trump
but
or Orban or...
No. Back at this time, it meant a sort of quite a different thing, nearly like a sort of pro-workers thing, would it have been?
Well, absolutely, because at that point, still, that probably at some point, switched at some point in the 1870s or 80s or 90s or something like that, the majority of workers in the United States, the majority of people who physically labored were farmers, I think, into the last decade.
As would have been throughout most of human history.
Indeed. But there's that just this weird confluence in the latter 19th century when you had fully formed representative democracy in the United States and you had not a proletariat or a working class, you had independent farmers who were at some points, if not a majority of U.S. voters, were a very, very, very significant part of it. And what's interesting about Williams's whole thesis is basically, what we're talking about today is, like, how did it happen? Why did and I think we've talked about this transition before, how did we go from the U.S. Empire of North America, which had a very democratic roots, essentially, well, democratic, of course, for white men, desperately wanted to go out and steal land from the indigenous. How did we get from that, that had a real democratic push behind it, as evil as it may have been, how did we get from that to what we have today, which is just like, we're bombing the Middle East for the benefit of a few engineers and a few stockholders for a few defense companies.
So they have a good quarter?
Yeah, exactly. Like, what? Why? How did that happen? And what I found interesting, this is probably the third or fourth William Appleman Williams book that I've read. He's most famous for The Tragedy of American Diplomacy. This one he sort of fleshes out at great length, and I think I can finally tell you who the presidents were between the Civil War and Teddy Roosevelt, thanks to this book, which goes in absurd detail.
But Appleman died in, was it the 90s?
Appleman Williams died in 1990 or thereabouts.
Yeah, so this is an old, this quite often, you know, you talk about books that are just out. This is quite the opposite. Is this book 1960s or 70s?
So William Appleman Williams wrote The Tragedy of American Diplomacy in 1959. I think this one came out in the 60s. Most of his books came out. So this is a tremendously influential figure. And there's a reason why I've read all of his books. I'm not sure I agree with his thesis. I'm not sure I agree. But he really dives in and takes a critical eye towards this all-important transition that we focus on a lot on this podcast and in a book that I'm writing right now. So there's a reason I'm so into William Appleman Williams and what he claims, which is I'm just not 100% sure I buy, which is interesting, is that that switch from we're colonizing the North America to we're going to control the world for the benefit of a few rich people is actually quite explicable and quite understandable because the farmers were for it. The populists the populists, more or less, there's a lot of stuff that is very complicated that we're making too simple here, but the populists were an actual political party for a period towards the end of the 19th century. They generally represented the interests of farmers. It's generally recognized that they wanted a few things. They wanted railroad companies to be regulated. They wanted silver to be brought back into circulation in the United States. They wanted the wealthy plutocrats, Wall Street. You know, probably the populist. No, it goes back as far as there's been a Wall Street, but the populists really put to, you know, the idea of demonizing Wall Street was very much something that was brought to further to the fore by the populace in the 19th century. But what Williams argues, and argues exhaustively and really puts together, is that at the same time, these populists, with their nominally somewhat more left-leaning concerns of regulating these abusive companies and cracking down on the banks or what have you, were also tremendously concerned with finding more international markets for their agricultural produce, and it's a case that he just makes over and over and over and over again. And Williams is most influential in strongly arguing that the impetus for U.S. empire, for this switch that McKinley made, really was economic, and it was all about as all business related. Before finishing this book this past weekend, I used to doubt his case more. This is a very persuasive book, mostly because it is just it is 500 pages of quotes of people saying, we're farmers and we want those international markets. We're farmers. China belongs to us. You know, it gets, and I'm not 100% convinced.
Would they have been competing with the likes of Argentina and stuff at the time, or who was their big competition and who was the big market they wanted to break into?
They were most worried about the British and the Russians for competition. The British, because they really did run the world at that point. One of the cases that... So one of the great, great political speeches, one of the greatest political speeches in U.S. history that a lot of people learn about if they're into history is William Jennings Bryan, his Cross of Gold speech. William Jennings Bryan, his Cross of Gold speech, fabulous. And so this is when the Democratic Party decided to basically adopt a whole bunch of the populists' approaches after being kind of business focused under Grover Cleveland, and really, I think Grover Cleveland was like, was he the only Democrat elected in the 19th century after the Civil War? Might have been. So this is like this tremendously important thing, and you understand in history classes why William Jennings Bryan was a big deal. He actually famously, in the 20s as an old man, was involved in the Scopes Monkey Trial in a much more negative context. But anyway, but I never quite grasped, like, what is this? So why were the farmers so interested in adding silver to the gold standard, which had actually been the case in U.S. economy, but prior to the 1870s, it's sort of been snuck in by Eastern bankers or whatnot. We're just going to be the gold standard right now. But the main motivation, William Evan Williams argues, is that by adding silver, it was seen as a strike against the British Empire because Britain ran everything. And it was actually very gratifying reading this book and the amount of support there is for a thesis, something that I've argued many times before, which is that the United States was really just a part of Britain's informal empire up until World War I, when the credit switched, when Britain started owing more money to the United States rather than vice versa. And it's fascinating that was very much a part of the consciousness and part of the conversations in politics in the late 19th century. And what William Appleman Williams argues is that for 20 years before McKinley, there was this tremendous appetite on the part of farmers. They were just losing more and more and more as Andrew Carnegie and William Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan and these still famous names were becoming wealthy beyond the dreams of human avarice. The farmers were just losing and losing and losing. You know, there was a time where they could at least tell themselves that, say, in the time of Andrew Jackson or Thomas Jefferson, that, you know, the farmer was king, and that's what, you know, the country was about these independent yeoman farmers or whatnot. And then throughout the end of the 19th century and towards the end of it, they're just watching themselves lose and lose and lose and lose. And I think what William Appleman Williams argues, or at least leads to the argument, that this incredible angst and fear of losing out that was directed at Wall Street, directed at the robber barons, was redirected by William McKinley and, you know, those elites that he served towards foreign aggression, towards the building of foreign empire. And that's a fascinating thesis that I find fairly persuasive, though I'm not 100% persuaded. And that is where you get the switch from the third to the fourth party systems.
Okay.
In the aftermath of the Civil War, you had essentially the Wild West era of U.S. politics, with the Gilded Age being built up on the East Coast. You had people going out and settling the frontiers, cowboys, what have you. People were very conscious by the 1870s and into the 1880s that was ending. And it was actually a period very much like where we are now, where people are very conscious that a political system, a party system, just briefly, so U.S. history can be divided into six party systems. In most of those party systems, you've got the Democrats versus the Republicans, but what those parties mean are very different things. So certainly since the 1860s, it's always been Republican versus Democrat, but we've had like the third, the fourth, the fifth, and the sixth party systems, which just means that the parties came to signify, usually in a transformative election, something completely different. And McKinley's victory in 1896 is a point at which it came to mean something completely different. So you had this populist ferment. We've been talking about the farmers who feel disenfranchised. You had the Democratic Party in 1896 deciding, okay, we're just going to go whole hog. We're going to go anti the gold standard. We're going to go anti the business elites and the East Coast. William Jennings Bryan, this incredible orator, supposedly making one of the best speeches in the history of U.S. politics. And then on the other side, you have McKinley, who's saying, we're going to take all this energy and we're going to turn it into a force of U.S. empire. And that's exactly what he did. So McKinley really is a tremendously transformative U.S. president, and it's kind of crazy. And I think he's kind of been robbed in that we remember Teddy Roosevelt instead of William McKinley.
The main, when it exploded, would he have been aware that it wasn't really Spain, or did he not care? Was this just a good excuse to start a war with Spain, or did they not necessarily want to get involved in that?
I don't think he cared, but Williams argues that even though the war didn't start until, I believe, 1898, in 1896, when you had this titanic election clash between William Jennings Bryan and William McKinley, Cuba was already an issue. And certainly McKinley wasn't already saying, oh, we're going to, like, you know, we're going to fight Spain. But the fact that he was saying we're going to look out for U.S. interests in Cuba, he knew, he leveraged the Cuba issue much better than William Jennings Bryan, who was like, oh, it's all the gold standard and this is all that's going to matter. Da, 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 da. So there's a lot of discussion or thought about, like, you know, what did William McKinley go through? The agonizing over each step of, am I going to get involved in the war with Cuba? Am I going to try to annex it? Am I going to get involved with it? And I think there's a lot of history that just strikes me as sort of copied over propaganda. Like, I just don't know. Maybe William McKinley truly had no idea what he was doing and just sort of inadvertently ended up being the guy who annexed Hawaii, annexed Puerto Rico, annexed the Philippines, Guam, and sort of intervened in the Cuban War to the extent that Cuba was pretty much a more or less protectorate of the United States from 1898 until Fidel Castro in the late 1950s, early 60s. So,
because was that his first term? He was trying to pressure Spain into giving Cuba independence?
Well, that's the interesting thing about the Spanish-American War is that it's and Williams is pretty good on this as well. It's an open question, certainly in the propaganda from the William Randolph Hearst, the yellow press, they called it, the very warmongering press and statements for public consumption. The United States and its politicians are very much on the side of the Cuban people or what have you. But it's pretty clear that the United States was as afraid of the Cuban revolutionaries as we were of the Spanish government. And what really, this revolution had been ongoing. There had been multiple phases of Cuban revolution against the Spanish. This particular fight, I believe, started in 1895. Remember, it was already an issue in the 1896 election. But what really got the United States convinced that they should get involved was the fact that it seemed like the revolutionaries were winning. And keep in mind, this was in a context of where most of the country was under Jim Crow laws. The Republicans nominally were the more pro-African-American party, but the period of Reconstruction had ended in 1876. And part of the deal in 1876 was that even though the Democrat probably had won the election, the Republican would get power as long as they agreed to abandon Reconstruction in the South and largely abandon African-Americans in the South. So you've got certainly a Republican administration that's nominally more friendly to African-Americans, but you've got a context of very strong white supremacy in the United States at that point. And the prospect of these Cuban revolutionaries who tended to be a lot of the military tended to be Afro-Cuban, a lot of that revolutionary army, that the prospects of that were very, very disturbing,
very dangerous
to the United States. and also, I mean, ongoing war is bad for the very significant economic interests that already, U.S. economic interests that already existed in Cuba. So anyway, it's a long way to say that so much of basically the starting gun, the beginning of the U.S.'s overseas empire is all William McKinley. Yet Teddy Roosevelt is the guy that we remember, his vice president who happened to be there when he happened to get shot, when McKinley was shot in Buffalo.
Did Teddy expand on much himself, or did he pretty much just coast off?
Well, the big thing that you can definitely attribute to Teddy Roosevelt is Panama. Like, he invented it. Colombians didn't, for years, even into the McKinley administration, the focus for people who wanted to build a canal across the sort of, as the whole thing, an isthmus, and the stretch of land in between North and South America, Nicaragua had been the focus for a long time.
So I think Scotland tried to, like, hundreds of years earlier. Like, it's been a common thing people had tried and failed to do.
And actually, I mean, the Scottish might have gotten it right, didn't they? Maybe they did try it in the area that became Panama.
But they were unable to get in a patch of... They managed to find somewhere in the world that rained more than Scotland. The wood never the wood never dried out, so they were, like, unable to build any more boats. So they were kind of a bit bankrupt and stuck.
Oh, and that was, like, the late 1600s, yes. Right? And it was because that effort failed so badly, they had no choice but to become part of the United Kingdom, right?
To become the United Kingdom, yes.
So that's a classic. Certainly over 200 years later, Colombia was not willing to give Teddy Roosevelt the terms that he wanted for building a canal in Panama. Teddy Roosevelt is credited with engineering a Panamanian revolution that rather quickly took over that land from Colombia and gave the United States a canal zone that it actually, I believe, held on to until the 1990s. It was more or less U.S. territory. Do I remember that John McCain was born there or something? I could be wrong about that.
But it reminds me, it's fixed a problem that Russia has, which is it's very difficult for Russia to move its navy about its giant landmass, but Panama meant America could move its navy ships from one side to the other relatively easily, thus helping its expansion around the world.
So that was a huge thing that Teddy Roosevelt did, but compared to the Philippines, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, it's kind of small beans. I think one reason, and something you always have to mention with William McKinley, is I don't recall the details on how exactly, because it was a long and complex process, how exactly did the decision to jump in on the Spanish-American War was made. What is, I think, more famous, perhaps as a piece of public relations, perhaps as what actually happened, is William McKinley agonizing personally for days over what to do with the Philippines. So the weird thing is that, William Appleman Williams, the historian, does have some passages on this. It's just sort of a strange thing that this was a war about Cuba. This was a war about the Americas. But at some point, you know, it just by some strange alchemy, it was decided that if we were to, you know, go to war against Spain to defend Cuba, it was only natural that we had to take the Philippines as well on the other side of the world. That's just simply part of the...
Just the largest ocean away.
That's just part of the process. It can't be helped. They're both Spanish possessions. I'm, you know, surprised we didn't, you know, decide we had to take the Rock of Gibraltar as well. Well, I guess the British already had that. Yeah. But there was some agonizing over. So what to do now that we've? It was quite a really even as I think even more dominating than the Japanese destruction of those Russian fleets a few years later. In the Russo-Japanese War, very quickly, Dewey, I think, was the admiral, sunk the Spanish fleet in the Philippines, and we were in control, at least in a naval period. Of course, this is something that Cuba and the Philippines have in common. The Filipinos were in the middle of a war of independence at the same time. And I think in both cases, the rebels had besieged important cities in Cuba and the Philippines. And the United States came in, beat the Spanish, replaced the Spanish, and told the rebels they could go home without ever actually entering those cities. And after some agonizing, William McKinley decided that, in fact, it's our responsibility to annex the Philippines. So for 50 years, the Philippines were U.S. territory after that decision.
This is also described as America's isolationist phase, which I always find funny.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me started on the 1920s, which are like our great period of isolation during which we were telling every navy in the world, how many ships they could have, and were also, you know, owned the finances of every European country. But I digress. But I, excellent point. You've put me on into another rant, Rory. And that decision by William McKinley perhaps has a lot to do with why he's so forgotten and why people focused on charismatic Teddy Roosevelt, who the construction of the Panama Canal, my understanding, is an incredibly bloody affair.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But the actual sort of creation of Panama, stealing of that land from Colombia, was, you know, largely successful, and I don't think too horrifically bloody. Because of the Philippines, William McKinley might be the first U.S. president to kill over 1 million people.
Well, yeah, just a horrendous thing to think about, all the deaths each president is responsible for.
Yeah. So I think, you know, George W. Bush and William McKinley are probably our furthest up there, depending on how you want to talk about Woodrow Wilson and FDR. Woodrow Wilson and FDR did not actually start their respective world wars. They ended them. I don't think you can blame them as much as you can blame George W. Bush and William McKinley. I think it's probably unfair to say that he killed over 1 million people. I think that's a high estimate of how many the United States murdered in the Philippines. Probably more along the lines of 500,000, or maybe even as low as 250,000. Still, murdering 250,000 people to establish an empire that really didn't do much for us other than get us into a war with Japan.
He's also considered to be a progressive. What progressive policies would he have implemented?
Well, William McKinley, it's interesting. I was looking at that question specifically this morning, and I don't think that he is as well known as, you know, he was the first president of the fourth party system, which is remembered for its progressivism. And Teddy Roosevelt is remembered as a progressive. William McKinley, less so. He is sort of seen, I think, as more of an avatar of big business and expansion.
Do you think Teddy would have run on his own steam, or was it just the fact he was vice president at the time?
Oh, Teddy Roosevelt was a tremendously ambitious politician. That is a very interesting question, though. Was he a good politician? There's no question that he was an excellent marketer. And there's a
hype man.
Yeah, great hype man, and that's a key part of modern politics that, you know, he made more of a key part of modern politics. But William McKinley won two elections. Teddy Roosevelt never did that.
And is it considered that the Republicans pretty much won until the 30s?
Mostly, except for when Teddy Roosevelt screwed them over.
Oh.
because Teddy Roosevelt did win under his own steam. It's interesting. So McKinley and Roosevelt both benefited from a tremendous economic boom that was mostly in marked contrast to, I think there was a panic of 1873 and then there was a panic of 1893. And really the whole, it's an interesting contrast because it's a period of time when certain people in the United States economy were getting extraordinarily wealthy. But the majority of Americans, like for decades, were suffering. They just weren't doing very well. They were getting forced into factory work. The farmers who managed to stick it out weren't doing very well, like for decades. And that finally began to let up under McKinley and Roosevelt. So there was a tremendous economic tailwinds behind McKinley and Roosevelt. So really, Roosevelt managed to win a single election on his own power in 1904. Then he decided not to run again. I don't know the details behind that decision. But after his successor, William Howard Taft, most famous for being probably our fattest president, and eventually going to run
the Supreme
Court. Is
Trump number two?
Hmm?
Is Trump the second fattest president?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I can't believe that. I mean, because most of the 19th century presidents, it was a different time. You know, they're very stocky.
Yes, it was good to be fat.
Except for Abraham Lincoln, of course, and other examples. But, you know, I mean, there were some large presidents. But none as large as William Howard Taft, who I think had a...
Does he get stuck in the bath a lot?
I think that's like... that he famously had a custom bathtub because he was so large.
Incredible.
But anyway, in 1912, Teddy decided that the country needed him back. So he split the Republican vote, and that's how we got Woodrow Wilson. I think the lone Democrat between... I think it's just Cleveland and Wilson. Are they the only Democrats between the Civil War and World War II? And FDR? I think they might be. And the Great Depression, essentially. They could be wrong about that. But Teddy Roosevelt, not a great politician. He basically gave the Republican Party one of its only losses, which ended up being tremendously significant because, you know, Woodrow Wilson ended up shaping the country and the world in a number of ways that... as we've discussed earlier on this podcast, may not have been to the best. Teddy Roosevelt, not a very good politician. Like William McKinley, kind of an extraordinarily successful politician, extraordinarily transformative figure, first president to kill a million people.
I'm just surprised that this man doesn't come up a lot more. The fact that the Republicans love the gold standard, he seemed to bring it in. He seemed to gain a huge amount of land. He seemed to, I don't know, I just find it's... Also, there's so much... I know this isn't quite what we're talking about, but there's so much fodder for conspiracy theories involving the ships blowing up and his death. It felt like, why is he so obscure?
I think he's just a little too far back.
Okay.
I would,
the first televised inauguration?
No, not William McKinley, no.
Okay.
That's way before television.
Not televised, but a film, sorry.
Oh, yeah, I think that's, I don't know if, I certainly saw photographs, and I definitely saw a film of his funeral doing the research on McKinley. He's a tremendously important figure in the modernization of politics. I think he's just a little too far back.
Okay.
I think there probably were, in the 1940s, you could probably find a bunch of people who wanted to talk about McKinley and what about that anarchist that shot him and, you know, sort of, I don't know, Republican clubhouses or something like that. Much the way that John F. Kennedy is still less than he used to be, but still a topic of fascination.
Oh, definitely.
But it's interesting watching that fade, to be quite honest. when I was a kid, Oliver Stone came out with this movie in the 90s. It was just constantly... revisited, and Camelot, and Jackie O was still alive and walking around. His poor glamorous son and glamorous wife died in a plane crash in the 90s. But I watched that sort of fade, and I bet there were plenty of McKinley partisans that are no longer alive. Just simply didn't care. There's a lot of assassinated presidents.
Well, I think he was
Garfield,
the third, was he?
Lincoln, Garfield, McKinley, Kennedy? Is there another one I'm missing? I mean, I think a lot of other ones have been shot. Teddy Roosevelt was shot. Ronald Reagan was shot. Teddy Roosevelt famously was shot and then finished the speech, which is another part
good.
Of the... Yeah, is always another a part of the Teddy Roosevelt legend. I think that might have been when he was running in 1912, but don't quote me on that.
Did he bring in protectionism for like factory workers and stuff?
No. So he did not bring it in. So,
okay.
But he definitely. So he was famous in the. He was governor of Ohio, I think, directly prior to becoming U.S. president. But I think in the Senate,
1892 to 1896.
Yeah, I think perhaps in the U.S. Senate, he was famous for putting forward a tariff. A thing about the United States in the 19th century is that there was always a tariff, and quite high tariffs. In fact, I was kind of this William Appleman Williams book was talking about like 40% tariffs on certain goods, extraordinarily high. That was how the U.S. government made its revenue at that point was through.
And that's how you'd argue it's quite protectionist by today's standards.
Oh, 100%. That's the incredible hypocrisy of the Washington consensus. That the United States has been pushing free trade on everybody for the past 40 years when, especially against developing countries, when during the great period of U.S. development throughout the 19th century, the United States was always very protectionist. So the gold standard was established not established, but essentially the bimetallism. All of this is very complicated. My understanding is that until the 1870s, gold and silver were accepted as a basis of U.S. currency, and then somewhat surreptitiously in the 1870s, silver was abandoned, and the battle was basically between people trying to get silver back in there, and I think McKinley settled the battle, but there had really been a de facto gold standard in the United States from the 1870s. So McKinley was certainly part of... Well, what's interesting about a difference between the historian, William Eppeman Williams, and what I've been sort of looking at in Wikipedia research is that Williams argues that actually, in fact, he was not... He did end up being a president who put forward some legislation in support of the gold standard, but that's not what he ran on. He didn't really necessarily... He was actually ran on being kind of silver curious, if you will. okay. So it's a... essentially, that whole issue faded because under McKinley, the economy finally recovered. And I don't think that necessarily had much to do with McKinley as it had to do with the development of world markets, that constant battle between the always growing U.S. surplus and the ability of foreign markets to suck it up.
Was there much riches from defeating Spain?
Well, there was certainly the most important economic value was the economic control of Cuba, which became quite extensive in immediately after the Spanish were kicked out. By 10, 15 years after Cuban independence, the United States was tremendously present in specifically in...
Because Cuba would have been such an incredible pinch point at the time for America, just to have this very large and relatively wealthy island just constantly not under their control.
Absolutely. They hated it. I think we did a podcast episode, didn't we, on Ada Ferrer's book,
yes.
Cuba and American History, which focused certainly on all Cuban history, but was very focused on U.S. and Cuban history and the way that they've interacted. And yeah, it's absolutely the case that, you know, the United States wanted Cuba for quite some time, and it was actually quite... It was interesting. It's an interesting political story. I can never remember what the name of the amendment is. But there was the Teller Amendment or the Platt, probably the Teller Amendment, because there's two amendments that mean very different things. One of them is an amendment to the Cuban Constitution that basically said the United States can intervene whenever it wants. But then there was an amendment or a proviso or something like that that was put into U.S. law, or at least a U.S. resolution, saying that the United States could not annex Cuba. That's why we never tried to take over Cuba the way we took over Philippines and Puerto Rico. Because it had been, because opponents of this war were like so just adamant that we actually try to preserve Cuban freedom. And we kind of did, but we kind of didn't. We quickly dispossessed those rebel armies that had almost taken over the country. The history in that Ada Ferrer book, the history of the very, you know, largely Afro-Cuban military with, you know, Afro-Cuban generals, how most of them ended up dispossessed, a lot of them ended up dead. You know, I'm not saying Fidel Castro is a good guy, but
you could definitely see why he got
did
support.
They have a point. Yeah, exactly. A lot of abuses.
I can understand one reason why the Ben Shapiro types might not be so enthralled with him is that he seemed to make the government stronger in sort of, you know, day-to-day life. He wasn't just
Absolutely.
Letting the companies and corporations just run rampant.
It's interesting, despite the fact that populist has become such a dirty word, I think both the Republican and Democratic parties of today, aspects of the 19th century populist sort of farmer political movement, and see aspects of that legacy that they'd like to claim. William Jennings Bryan is a great example. He was the great, he was a Democrat, but he was supported by a ton of populists and farmers. He was the great... you know, to be against the gold standard was to be against those elitists, those businessmen, this, that, and the other thing. But William Jennings Bryan ended his career in the 1920s He ran against McKinley again, I believe, in 1900, and then I think was done as a national, you know, presidential candidate or what have you. But in the 1920s, he was on the other side of the Scopes Monkey Trial, which is a, I believe, a high school, the details escape me at this point, but I believe a high school teacher was prosecuted for teaching evolution to his students.
Okay.
And I think it was Clarence Darrow, who's a famous U.S. attorney, defended this teacher, and William Jennings Bryan, the great old man of, you know, populism and farmers and fighting against the man, came out to prosecute this guy in the name of Jesus Christ or what have you. And it's just an interesting, I bring that up to indicate just how mixed these legacies are. So populism is something, and being against the elites is something that's popular for both sides, Republican and Democratic today. And the fact that, as you I think very savvily pointed out, I think the fact that McKinley isn't really claimed by anybody is he's the guy who beat that. You know, he's the guy who won for the elites. You know, like, so that's kind of hard. Whereas Teddy Roosevelt found a way to market, I'm making the rich richer by building U.S. empire. He found better ways to market that, specifically through stepped up progressivism, I think. Though the extent to which, I don't have it clear in my mind what kind of progressive reforms Roosevelt's carried out, other than, I mean, I know that Wilson did a lot of stuff, and I know that Teddy Roosevelt created the national park system, which is great, but I'm not sure what kind of concrete reforms he actually did. Regardless, he has the reputation as being a progressive, which makes up for the fact that, you know, his, what he was doing was making the world safe for rich American investors. And McKinley, I think, has less of that cover, and perhaps he would have built that cover had he survived.
Did McKinley's both children die quite young?
Oh, I didn't look into that.
And was his wife crippled at some point, so he had to look after him a lot of the time?
Oh, I don't know. I did read this absolutely heartrending. I mean, what a horrific, I mean, horrific, but just incredibly melancholy way to go. He was shot on September 6th, 1901.
8 days, was it?
Yeah, and it apparently, I mean, it doesn't seem like it was eight agonizing days.
Okay.
It seems like he was, had it together. Well, he was shot in the stomach, which is famous before the years, the antibiotics was a famously horrific way to die. In that, you know, he, for the first couple of days, he was more or less walking around. They got one of the two bullets out. He was able to keep the mob from killing the guy who shot him.
Yeah, that, which is an interesting thing to say.
Yeah.
I don't think I could come out with such a statement in quite a moment. No, leave that man alone that tried to kill me.
Don't worry. I mean, this was. I think he died, you know, shot September 6th, died September 14th. Leon Czolgosz, I'm sure.
It's quite a name.
Was tried and executed in the electric chair, I believe, at the end of October. So it was not, justice was not slow in coming. But it seems like he was, and his wife was able to come out and see him, and doctors were optimistic. And then it just, over the course of a week, it's like, oh, and, you know, just to truly know that you're going to die. I mean, there's some justice there. This is, of course, the first president that killed a million people. But it is a fascinating story that I just hadn't really thought about much. And it is...
But it's also interesting, if he hadn't have been assassinated, what way that second term would have panned out.
Well, and also because he seems to have been a tremendously successful politician, tremendously, unquestionably, he was in hoc to a lot of wealthy elite forces in the United States. But there's a famous quote, could just be public relations, from Mark Hanna, who was sort of his political fixer, saying like, oh, no, if you think McKinley is going to do what we want, you've got another thing coming. I mean, he did appear to have serious political savvy of his own. I look at McKinley and I'm like, gosh, this is kind of, in how transformative he was, how successful he was in foreign policy. This guy kind of looks not like a Teddy Roosevelt. This guy kind of looks like a Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, the fact he's able to sort of keep the populace happy whilst keeping the elites happy as well does seem like a very unique thing to be able to do.
Yeah, and he was shot at, I think, the age of 58. So it's entirely possible to imagine.
Which is quite young for a president these days.
So it's possible to imagine a William McKinley perhaps being the first three-term president instead of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So perhaps he could have been elected in 1896 and, you know, not left until 1908 or something. Is it study the math right there? Yeah. And that would have been a very different... We'd certainly remember a very different William McKinley, Teddy Roosevelt.
And it could be a very different world.
Yep. Teddy Roosevelt could very well have been an amusing footnote rather than on Mount Rushmore.
Yeah. Is there anything from this year of politics that you'd like to see for this, you know, election year?
Oh, gosh. Presidents in their 50s?
Yeah. Young presidents.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Yeah, well, I mean, what happened to the old Obama thing, you know? Like, as we're recording this, I think this is the day that Nikki Haley, who is in her 40s or 50s, has given up.
Is she going to be a third party candidate or independent or anything like that?
No, Nikki Haley wouldn't do that. No, her whole point in running was to position herself well to pick up the pieces in the Republican Party after Trump loses, if that's even going to happen. Which is a preview of our next episode.
Yes.
the Donald Trump catastrophe.
So he set America on course for dominating the world?
Indeed, indeed. After, if you believe William Appleman Williams, it was sort of what America had been crying out for decades. And he's the guy who finally did the math and figured out how to put it all together for a very successful tenure in power that, you know, only killed 1 million people. Ended up with him being shot in Buffalo, of all places.
By an anarchist.
By an anarchist, yes, indeed.
No, very fascinating man, and hopefully I'll look a bit more into him later on. But next time we'll be talking about a fascinating man for all the wrong reasons.
Indeed, indeed. Donald effing Trump.
All the best. Catch you next time.
Indeed.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.